Next up, Fran Michel's comments on American violence, the Stanford rape case, and yesterday's terrible mass shooting in Orlando. Fran.
Good morning. This is Fran Michel, here with some comments on violence in America. I had been planning to talk about the Stanford rape case, you know, the one in which Brock Turner was caught behind a fraternity house dumpster humping a completely unconscious woman, was chased down and detained by two Swedish graduate students who happened to be bicycling by, was tried and convicted on 3 counts of sexual assault, and was then given a 6-month sentence with time off for good behavior because the judge thought he was unlikely to do it again, even though he expressed no actual acknowledgement of what he'd done or remorse about it, and because a prison sentence would have a severe impact on Turner. Leaving aside the notion that that's presumably what prison sentences are supposed to do, have a severe impact on those who commit crimes, and leaving aside the fact that low rates of reporting arrest and conviction mean that Turner will spend more time in jail than 97% of rapists, and leaving aside that the judge, just before this case, gave a domestic abuser just a weekend in jail for having beaten his partner almost to death, and leaving aside that Turner lied about never having experience with alcohol or drugs or run-ins with the law before getting to Stanford, leaving aside the appalling comments from the rapist, from his father, who thought 20 minutes of action didn't deserve punishment, or his mother, who's so upset that she can't bring herself to decorate their new house, and his childhood friend, who blamed the case on political correctness, and all of whom revealed a complete indifference toward the suffering of the victim, the case has gotten a lot of attention, probably partly because of the powerfully eloquent statement by the survivor. So I thought I would talk about sexism and rape culture, although those topics were well addressed by Positively Revolting Talk Radio this past Friday. But I might mention the lessons one can learn about consent by considering the analogy of offering someone a cup of tea. If they do not want tea, you should not try to make them drink it. And if they are unconscious, you don't even have to ask if they want tea, because unconscious people don't want tea, and they can't answer the question, "Do you want tea?" because they're unconscious. And definitely don't force them to drink. Even if they took a sip or two on their own before they were unconscious, don't continue making them drink it. I might point out that for all the discussion of what the rapist called the college campus drinking culture and the sexual promiscuity that goes along with that, it was, as the survivor pointed out, not drinking that was wrong, but sexual assault, and promiscuity had nothing to do with it. Quote, "Alcohol was not the one who stripped me, fingered me, had my head dragging against the ground with me almost fully naked. We were both drunk," she told him in her statement. "The difference is I did not take off your pants and underwear, touch you inappropriately, and run away." Anyway, I thought I might talk about the pervasive rape culture that used a yearbook photo instead of a mugshot, referred incessantly to his brilliant accomplishments as a swimmer, worried about his future and not hers, and led investigators to ask her about her clothing, her drinking habits, and her sexual history, the kinds of inappropriate questions I thought feminists had tackled and gotten rid of back in the 70s. I thought I might talk some about the class dimensions of sexual assaults on non-students by fraternity members and athletes at posh universities, and the failure of Stanford to express regret to the victim or to offer to pay any of her medical expenses out of Stanford's $22.2 billion endowment. I thought I might talk about the racial bias of sentencing practices that led to a black college athlete, Corey Beatty, also convicted of raping an unconscious woman, facing a sentence 3,000 times what Brock Turner will serve. Or to the case of a black minor, Brian Banks, having been tried as an adult and wrongfully convicted, spending 6 years of what might have been a 41-year sentence imprisoned for a crime he didn't commit. I thought I might talk about why it would be wrong to use this case as a reason to argue for increased prison sentences, because although the disparity in sentences is grievously wrong, giving Turner a longer sentence won't let anyone out early. Longer sentences do not deter crime, and of course, increasing the power of the carceral state just means increasing the weapons that will be used against the already disempowered. Finally, I thought I might talk about the wearying applicability of statements made years ago about rape and rape culture. But then I woke up yesterday morning to the news of the shooting at a Latino gay bar in Orlando during Pride Month. So now I'm going to talk about the wearying applicability of a slightly different but overlapping set of points. For instance, again, class is relevant and healthcare is expensive. The violence in Orlando was, again, directed at the vulnerable, this time at queer people, queer brown people, and has created more vulnerability that the U.S. is structurally unequipped to address. As Eitan Bridges pointed out, aside from the 50 or so who have died, there are another 50-some with gunshot trauma requiring very expensive medical care, and some of those victims may die despite treatment, and their families will still be charged for treatment and will also have to pay for their burial. And some may face poverty and lifetime debt because of this. As Lisa Wade of Sociological Images points out, Brock Turner is breathing a sigh of relief as the largest mass shooting in American history by a single shooter takes him out of the headlines. But let's make sure to see the connections between his crime and Omar Mateen's and that of Kevin James Loibel, who killed Christina Grimmie, and the man who caught with explosives on his way to the Los Angeles Pride Parade. To end these massacres, we need to see what ties them together. As Wade points out, the alarming numbers of mass shootings and similar acts of violence are mostly carried out by white men with a sense of aggrieved entitlement. The apparent shooter in the Orlando case was also sexist. His ex-wife reported that he beat her. He was homophobic, according to his choice of target, and according to his father's statement that he was upset after seeing two gay men kissing in Miami a few months ago. Despite reports that he claimed he was acting in the interests of ISIS, his social media images suggest he had more fondness for the New York Police Department. He had a degree in so-called criminal justice and had worked for the past 10 years as a rent-a-cop for G4S, formerly known as Wackenhut. His semi-automatic AR-15 was legally purchased. This long-standing alliance with legalized violence seems at least as significant as any devotion to Daesh. It's not ISIS, but U.S. legislators who have been proposing measures that countenance discrimination against LGBTQ people in the United States. And it didn't take ISIS for gay lives and gay clubs to become subject to violence. Matilda Bernstein Sycamore reminds us, we need to make sure this doesn't end up as another opportunity for queers to be cynically used as tools for continued oppression here in the U.S. and around the world. We should not allow anyone, gay or straight or queer, to justify even more Islamophobia, serving as cover for U.S. military aggression around the world and oppression here in the U.S. Hate crimes legislation just gives a criminal legal system more power. Gun control just means that law enforcement has control over who gets to shoot. The conversations we need to have are the ones about how to end structural oppression of all kinds in this country and ensure that violence like this doesn't happen here or anywhere else in the world. For the Old Mole Variety Hour, this has been Fran Michel.